Podcasting from the beautiful Mile High City, you're listening to the Do It Again podcast, the official podcast of Scientific Wrestling, the undisputed leader in no-holds-barred, catch-as-catch-can wrestling. Here's your host, Jake Shannon.
Okay, now.
Okay, good. So we were talking about... you went to the your karate school. You've been wrestling since you were eight, but then you start taking the karate, and it's pretty hardcore compared to what you're seeing at karate tournaments, though.
Yeah, it was it was just a lot different experience, and you know, but it was a good one because you know, I grew up doing you know, old school hard nosed Texas karate, and you know, it was. It was a great experience for me. And, you know, what I found was, even though I was a state champion wrestler and all this, is that I didn't have great training wrestling. I had a coach my freshman year when I lived in the state of Washington who did an amazing job, an amazing coach, amazing human being, who taught me a lot about, you know, so he taught me so well that I was able to not really learn too much new and still win the championship, but it had a lot to do with Texas wrestling not being that great in the 80s. And so, you know, the thing is that one of my genetic gifts was I was very strong. You know, I was a strong guy. I guess I look strong, but I'm stronger than I look. How about that?
There you go.
The thing that I found out was I was a very strong boy when I went to college, and I'm wrestling against some very strong men. Who knew how to wrestle a lot better than me. And so it was, you know, college wrestling was tough. You know, I wrestled for 2.5 years. I ended up getting caught in the crossfire of a drive-by and got shot in the leg. And even though it wasn't.
You got shot in the leg?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
you're just sitting in a car and a bullet hits you in the leg or something?
No, they, we were outside. We were out in front of a Burger King, actually. And, yeah.
Anyways, oh, my God. How old were you?
18.
Oh.
And, see, I was in college at 17. You know, like I said, I was a strong boy. But, yeah, I was 18. And it's actually interesting. I tell people all the time. It's like people ask me about why I don't have my son cut weight. I go, cutting weight will be the reason they quit, because I had to cut so much weight to make the team because I was on scholarship. It's a long story. I really had to bust my ass on scholarship. And he said, you're going to stay on scholarship. You make 157. Now I'm 6 foot and I weigh 185 pounds.
Just yeah. About
6'1", and I weigh 205. It's not like I'm big or fat, right?
So, right.
So that cut was a bitch. So when I got shot, I realized it was okay. I was okay. You know, it wasn't that serious a wound or anything that I was happy because wrestling season was over. I knew I wasn't going to have to make that weight. So parents, just so you know, when you're happy to be shot versus making weight, you may want to consider, you know, making sure your kid doesn't make that weight.
Oh my God. That's the funniest thing I've heard. That's hilarious. Holy shit.
True, so also. So the funniest part about it, it's actually true. And so, but
so
the bad side about that, this is the 80s. They didn't have protected scholarships. And so I ended up getting off the scholarship. And so I, you know, being a poor kid, I really couldn't afford to go to school there. And so I came back home and fumbled around with school a little bit, just getting in trouble. And then I had an opportunity to fight in World Full Contact Karate League, and which was a Japanese style thing. I never really fought in it before. But that style, but you know, I was good at fighting. Whatever it was, I could fight. I just, you know, tell me the rules and I'll figure it out.
Sure.
Ended up winning their world championship, and it just kind of petered out a little bit, you know. And the money wasn't good, and so I went over to boxing and kickboxing, and ended up, you know, become the number one rated heavyweight in the world at one point, and and then the UFC came along, and ended up fighting in the UFC 4. Then I won the world championship in kickboxing in 95. And then basically I defended it once and retired it just to, you know, stick with you know, no holds barred. And well, because really what happened was after UFC 5, I went to Pancras right after that. I had two fights in Pancras, and I defended the world championship one time just so I could say I defended it. And then I retired from kickboxing. Officially, you know, just stepped down and just basically stayed with the Pancras organization for the next, well, I don't know, 5 years, something like that, four years, something like that. So.
Wow.
And then I went back to UFC 13, won that. That's when you had to be the champion back then. You had to win the tournaments.
Tournament, yeah.
And, you know, and that's kind of, and everyone knows the rest.
So, okay. So it's 19, let's go to 1995. And, you know, the first UFC happens. I was actually
1993 was the first UFC.
I'm sorry. No, I thought it was 94. Wasn't it 94?
No, it was 93.
93. Okay. So let's go back. 93 rolls around. I ended up going to UFC 2, and the irony of ironies is because I was in college in Denver at the time and doing judo and this other stuff. And, you know, obviously UFC was cool. I went to UFC 2. First fight I saw was Sean Dougherty open up the event for UFC 2. So it's 1993. You hear of the UFC. Did you hear of it back in 93 or how did?
Oh, yeah. I saw the very first one, but I thought it was a pro wrestling gig, you know?
I said,
it's complete bullshit. Ain't no one gonna let this happen, right?
Yeah.
I'll tell you where they made a believer of me. When you guard go kick that poor sumo in the face and his teeth go flying out, you could have heard a pin drop in the room that we were at. And I was like, holy crap.
Those early ones were gnarly, man. Those early UFCs were so gnarly.
Yeah, it was more, you know, I'll be honest. It was more the fact that there were the format. You know, the athletes are better today because we know how to prep for it, you know. It's not that they're better athletes. It's just, man, shit, we never had rule. We never had no time limits, no weight classes, no rules. I mean, it was like, you know, because UFC 1 originally, there was no eye gouging and no kicking to the groin, right?
Right.
So call out all the you know the jokers like Dillman and those guys, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, you know, you can't eye gouge or kick the groin, as if your entire system consists of kicking people in the nuts and poking them in the eyes. Because if that's your entire system, you have a weak system, you know. But so UFC 2, they took all the rules out, you know. And you know, I'll be honest, man, I didn't sleep good once I agreed to it. I knew I could win, you know. I mean, I remember seeing Ken Shamrock walk out in UFC 1.
Yeah,
I told everybody, I said, I'm going to go train with that guy.
Yeah.
And it's funny. I mean, it was like prolific. Everyone's looking at me laughing. Yeah, sure, whatever. But, you know, I ended up, you know, obviously becoming one of his teammates. And so, and training partners. And so, you know, it was funny, though, because when I agreed to fight in UFC 4, you know, I didn't sleep good very much after that. I remember thinking, you know, it was weird because, you know, I'm thinking, man, I know me. I'm not going to tap. So,
yeah,
I'm in a bad position. I'm going to die out there. I'm going to be the first guy killed in the UFC if I don't win this thing, you know. Because, it was funny because actually they were like, because they were doing all these interviews, right? You know, you did your pre-fight interview and all these guys were like going, I can't wait to get in there to do this. And I can't wait to prove myself this and not, you know, all this stuff. And they asked me, they go, so, you know, how you feel? I go, well, I'll be honest, man. I don't know about you. I've listened to all these guys. I said, am I the only one who hadn't slept good since they agreed to do this? Because I go, because I'm afraid to admit that I'm kind of afraid of this thing, you know? it was kind of like, it was true. I was a little nervous about it, but I said it to kind of elicit, you know, a comedic response.
Yeah.
Everyone looked around at me and there nobody laughed. And then one of the ladies, I can't remember her name now. Really nice. She ran the thing at the time. She goes, you know, guy, we can find somebody else if you're really scared. And I remember looking at her and I just started laughing. I was like, listen, this nice guy act stopped the moment I step in the ring. So don't worry about me. But it was so funny because they literally thought, I guess I was convincing enough to let them know I was scared, but nobody else actually was, I think, honest about it. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, it's honest. I think it is an honesty thing because, I mean, even, you know, I Mark Schultz, the wrestler, is a good friend of mine. And he, you know, I always ask him to tell me a story about him with Hickson. And it was kind of a similar thing. He was like, you know, here he is, a gold medalist and a tough guy and all that kind of stuff. But he was actually scared. He was like, man, I don't know what to expect if this, like, no rules fight thing. Like, it freaked him out. So, I mean, I think people today, you know, especially the young cats, they don't realize, like, back then, there had never been anything like that, that where you just go in and you just go at each other, and there's no YouTube to scout guys. I mean, you have no idea what the hell's going on.
On top of it, the referees couldn't stop the fights back then.
Oh, wow.
The fights got stopped is if you were knocked out, you tapped out, or your corner threw in the towel.
Yeah, man, that takes a whole other kind of guts because it's the unknown. You know, you're like jumping out of the plane for the first time.
Yeah, because Big John, you know, he his thing, he goes, you know, if guy was in a bad place, he would be going, corner, watch out for your man, corner. You'll hear him say, watch out for your man, watch out, because you had to throw in the towel.
Whoa.
You know, if your boy was taking a beating, and you know, and so, yeah, I mean, listen, it was a trip, you know, I mean, there was a kind of a Wild West feel to it, you know, there was a, you know, Kimo's people were a bunch of idiots in UFC 3, and of course the Gracie family got upset with them, and we're gonna have a gang war in North Carolina because they were mad at Kima. I mean, it was insane stuff. And of course, you know, Tank Abbott and his crew, causing trouble. But you know, that was Tank's shtick. You know, he, you know, love him or hate him, man. You know, he brought it. Whether he got his ass kicked or he kicked ass.
Yeah, he had that whole, like, Huntington Beach biker gang kind of ethic, you know?
Yeah, and he actually, the clowns with them weren't, you know, they were there for show. But he lived that.
That is fascinating. Yeah, man, I mean, I'm sure you've got so many goddamn hilarious and interesting, fascinating stories from kind of behind the scenes to tell. But I want to know, you know, so you do UFC 4. I mean, how is it, what closes that gap between the guy Metzger that sees Ken walk out and is like, I'm going to train with that guy, to when you're actually at the Lion's Den working out with him? What's that journey look like?
Well, you know, I met Ken. Okay, so they remember the original format for UFC wasn't really athlete based. Okay, it was style based.
Yeah.
So what they wanted to have is styles against styles. So, you know, I was the number one rated kickboxer. So they wanted a kickboxer to fight a jiu-jitsu guy. So they had Jason Farron, who was the Canadian jiu-jitsu guy. And you know what they didn't know was that I was an all-American wrestler, and that I, you know, I was a, you know, undefeated boxer, two-time world full contact karate champion, you know, number one rated kickboxer, and also a national level judo player. And so, you know, so I mean, I was kind of a pre-runner of what the UFC athlete looks like today, you know?
Yeah, the cross-trained athlete.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's amazing. When you can't get a date, you have a lot of time to study martial arts. And I had an amazing amount of time. When you have no social life, you get to train. And that is the sad truth. You know, the thing is that, you know, they wanted that fight. So you see, they wanted this kickboxer, and they actually wanted to get Maurice Smith in it more than me. And then this guy named Anthony Elmore, they wanted him, but they didn't fight because Maurice was doing the K-1, and Anthony, he was kind of long in the tooth anyways, you know, and, you know, so then it kind of fell on, you know, I said, well, what about Guy Metzger, you know, and then who's that, you know, and, So I said, all right, I'll go. Let me see a UFC 3. So I went to UFC 3. They flew me out there just to have a look at it, you know, because I want to get a feel of it. And it was insane with the chemo thing and the whole thing with that. And so it was, you know, so I was like, man, I don't know if I want to get involved in this. Because to be honest, at heart, I'm a martial artist. At heart, I'm a sportsman, you know. And it wasn't a sport. I don't care what anybody says. It was a spectacle is what it was.
Yes. Yeah. And it was pro wrestling. I mean, it just happened to be a shoot, but it was pro wrestling. 100% spectacle.
Yeah. And I was a little uncomfortable with it, but here's the other thing too, is I had made, you know, I had a lot of accolades, but no money. I was 26 years old, about to turn 26 at the time. And I was like, dude, I got to get on with my life. So I said, you know what? I'll fight in this thing. I knew I could win it. And I was like, I'll fight in this thing. You know, say I fought in this crazy tournament. I said, they're going to stop this tournament. They're not going to allow no rules. They're going to stop it. And, you know, and then I could say I fought in this no rules thing and retire and just have, you know, some bragging rights to do that and get on with my life and do something else. Right.
Right.
And, you know, and then, so, you know, so what happened was Anthony Macias and me, we fought for a buddy, guy named Buddy Albin a lot. Buddy promoted most of my fights outside of Texas. And he was a site promoter for the UFC, and so he had the opportunity to put two athletes in there. So he put me and Anthony in, and so we flipped a coin to see who went in the tournament and who did the exhibition match. You know, the ultimate match. It wasn't an ultimate match. It was just they put a match together to give the guys a rest before they went in the finals. With sure. Whoever won got to go into the UFC, the next UFC.
Okay.
And so. So, you know, Anthony won, so he got to go in the tournament, and I had the fight with Jason Farron. And that put me in position for UFC 5, but I had made friends with Oleg Tatarov, and he was living with me and training with me.
Hmm.
And he was having visa issues, and so they were like, he might not be around to do this. So I let him take my space, and I did another alternate match. I was supposed to be in UFC 6, but then Pancrase offered me a contract, which was considerably more than than the UFC. And on top of it, I knew that, you know, one thing I am is like, I'm not the best athlete out there. I'm not the most, but I'm one of the smartest guys out there. I figure out how to beat everybody, you know? And so I was like, all right, I really need more training in this, right? You know, I need to have a format that has kick, punch, wrestle in it, you know, and submissions and stuff. So I can get better at this because, you know, a lot of good guys were starting to come out of the woodwork. You know, the wrestlers, like I knew once I saw Dan Severn, I was like, oh, there's going to be a lot of wrestlers come out. Because I knew that was – I've always looked at wrestling. I have the least amount of accolades as a wrestler. You know, I mean, I've won world championships and, you know, everything from, you know, 2014, I won the world jiu-jitsu championships, you know. I mean, all the way down and things like this. But I've never come close to getting anything important in wrestling. And – so I knew the, you know, when they started getting those NCAA All-Americans, the NCAA champions in there, man, it was going to change the dynamic. So I knew,
right.
I got to be ready for that because these guys won't be, you know.
Right.
So, you know, and so I made the decision not to go into the UFC 6. And well, I also made a financial decision because it was considerably more money fighting in Pancrase. And so I went to Pancrase and, you know, to basically fine tune my skills because I always had the dream. I being the UFC champion after that. I got the bug. I noticed, you know, to be honest, I was one of those kids who always wanted the recognition and stuff and, you know, and had self-esteem issues like everybody does. And so it was important for me to, you know, eventually take that, you know, go for that UFC, you know, but again, I want to win. I don't do anything to lose. You know, my goal is not to take second place in anything. It's to take first place.
Right. Right. So how does that happen? I mean, you're in UFC and then obviously somebody, maybe it's Ken himself is scouting you. He was the one scouting you for Pancrase or what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what happened was, you know, after UFC 3, I met Ken and Bob and Frank, and then I reached out to him and I said, hey, listen, man, I'm going to fight in UFC 4. I'd like to train a little bit with you guys just to see how I do. Cause I don't want to be killed in this thing. You know, I would like to have children one day. I mean, I don't want to die. And I knew they'd be straight shooters with me. And so I ended up, you know, flying out to Ken's and you know, Ken said, yeah, it was funny because Ken goes, he goes, yeah, man, you know, I'll work with you some, but I said, you know, I'm putting together our team, Lions Den, you know, you could do try out and, you know, you're going to need a team to make this thing work, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll do the tryout, you know, because, you know, I literally had, you know, I just defended the United States Kickboxing Championship that Saturday and that Monday I'm there with Ken. Right.
Wow. Okay.
So I was in good shape. You know, the fight I didn't get hurt in or nothing, you know, and so I was in good shape and I was like, oh yeah, what could this tryout be? Right. Well, the tryout is 500 squats, 500 sit-ups, 500 leg lifts, 200 push-ups, a mile and a half run done in 10 minutes. And then you got to fight for 15 minutes. Pancrase style, right? You basically left with open hands.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I got burning, and it was crazy. It was supposed to be 15 minutes, right? So there's a clock way – it was in this warehouse thing. In the back of the warehouse was this clock. And, you know, and I'm like, all right, I look at the clock. I said, all right, you know, 15 minutes, I can do this. And so I start going, and everyone thought Vernon was going to tool on me, but, you know, because, you know, I can't, I told him, well, I'm the U.S. kickbox champion. And I didn't really get a chance to tell him everything else. So he thought, okay, Vernon's just going to shoot in and take me down like this. And to be honest, you know, man, I tooled Vernon and you know. And so instead of 15 minutes, it literally goes 40 minutes. And I'm at this
point where
I'm like going, do I tell him that it's been 40 minutes? Because I'm like fucking exhausted. But Vernon did actually put me on the heel hook, man, and jacked my knee up pretty good. And so I'm sitting there going, what do I do, right? So I just kept my mouth shut, just kept fighting. And then so he called it about 40 minutes. Yeah, I was so sore, but you know that was the infamous Lions Den tryout. So
yeah, and infamous they certainly are. That's so crazy. So,
but that was copy. They do that with the pro wrestling stuff over there. That's what the Pancrase organization does, and almost all the pro wrestling over in Japan does. They have this.
Yeah, it's all that that old Carl Gotch squad. Yeah. Actually, Carl, when I I went out and visited him a couple times and. He made me go through it. It was like, you know, the difference is I didn't get my ass kicked because it was just him and I, but I do all the squats and the Hindu push-ups and all that shit. But you know what he did? He brought me, like, I went out to visit him in Ford in his little tiny apartment. You know, he lived like a monk after his wife died. And, I go out there, he gets me like, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm excited to meet Carl Gotch, you know, cause I'm a mark for Carl. So I drive over out there and I meet him. And I skip breakfast, and I was in okay shape. You know, I try to keep in okay shape. And he says, okay, come on, let's have a cigar. I don't smoke cigars. He makes me smoke this, like, huge cigar. I'm, like, green and sick to my stomach. He then gives me this plum wine, which is super sweet, which makes me even sicker. And then after all that, and I know it had to be a rib. He was probably laughing his ass off inside. Then he made me do the workout. It was, like, the worst thing ever. I was going to puke, like, the whole time. I never puked, but – that's the standard. You're right. Like even the pro wrestling dojos, like New Japan, everybody, they're doing that same kind of 500 squat level.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you know, yeah, pro wrestling's very theater now, you know, it's not even much wrestling in it anymore.
Right.
But it is very athletic. So these guys have to be able to, you know, take the punishment and be athletic. So it's so applicable.
One thing you mentioned that, you know, I think a lot of the younger cats and especially the people in kind of the catch-as-catch-can scene, you know, a lot of them know that clearly Pancrase kind of comes from catch wrestling roots. They know, Sakuraba, you know, was kind of the poster boy through the late 90s and early 2000s. But, I mean, you beat up Sakuraba too in a match.
Yeah.
Tell everybody a little bit about, you know, the lead up and the match itself and any aftermath to it?
Well, really it was, you know, they, you know, I was popular over in Japan, but I had, you know, I had left Japan, and I had, I lost my fight with Tito, and then, you know, and so, you know, I ended up having I had another fight with Pride. Pride asked me how to fight, but I had a kidney disorder called monoglobinuria, which is, and it was really bad, so. Literally the doctor said, you cannot do anything, no training, nothing. That's going to raise your creatinine levels for, you know, until we can clear your kidneys. And so it was like 6 months. I mean, not doing anything.
Is that something you still have to deal with, or is that like a permanent thing?
Yeah. Well, it damaged my kidneys. I got to deal with the damage I did to my kidneys, but I don't have the monoglobinuria anymore.
Okay.
At least it's
okay.
Under control. And,
well, that's good.
So, yeah. I get a phone call, you know, December, end of December, wanted me to fight Sakuraba. And
wow.
Of course, fight Sakuraba, I thought I could beat him. And, but I was like, man, I only have 3 weeks to get ready for this. I can't do it, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but to be honest, they threw so much fucking money at me. And then we made the agreement that we, you know, 15-minute round, you know, instead of the multiple rounds, like they were saying.
Yeah.
And I like, I could fight any human being on the planet for 15 minutes for this much money. And so that was the kind of agreement. And I whipped in shape. It was funny because I actually had the flu. Ken's kids had the flu, and I was run down from all the training. I ended up getting sick.
Oh.
I took 4 IV bags before I got on the plane. And I took 3 IV bags when I got to Japan.
That's wow.
But, you know, it was like one of those things where I just was, you know, the cards were aligned. You know, I mean, I fought. And but, you know, here's the thing. They wanted to beat me because I was a king of pancreas and all this other stuff.
Sure.
And popular over there. And they, you know, and so they wanted, you know, to beat me. And they wanted, you know, I was a legitimate guy to beat. They knew I had this kidney issue because I told them that's why I turned down. I turned down a couple of fights. So they knew that I hadn't been training. And then so they, you know, they basically set it up for me to lose. And it just didn't turn out that way. So they basically changed the rules in the middle of the fight. And, you know, and everyone knows the history of that. Just,
yeah, you know, like with Ken got involved and was pissed off. And
well, you know, they pulled a fast one.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, and of course they had one of the lackeys fall on the sword for the misunderstanding, you know, and everything, but they knew what was going on. They just didn't expect me to win. You know what I mean?
I mean, and you got the W in the win column. You got the check mark in the win column, though.
No, they did. They put it down as a no contest.
They did, really?
Yeah. And so they, you know, so when I went down there, you know, they first they were said I lost because Ken entered the ring and they disqualified me. And we're like, well, the fight's over. You know what I mean? This was the agreement. And you know, so, you know, we left and, you know, and then of course it all came out. And of course they do what Japanese always does is they throw more money at you. It was funny because I made pretty significant amount of money for the fight originally, but then they paid me off even more. Wow. So I wouldn't put up fuss because, you know, and in fairness to them, they wanted Sakuraba in there because he's the only Japanese athlete that could perform well at that. And so, me putting the damper on that for them, you know, really, you know, it wouldn't have sold in Japan the way it did. And we wouldn't have the awesome Gracie fight. I mean, I would hopefully have had that fight. But they wouldn't have tried so hard to get Gracie there if I was the guy fighting.
Right, because they wanted the hometown hero to fight.
They wanted Sakuraba.
Right.
So I understand it. You know, I mean, they really should have just said, hey, we call it a draw because of the misunderstanding, and then flip a coin and let him win the coin toss. You know what I mean? And, you know, because I don't really, like I said, I get that, you know, and the business, but the way they handled it was really negative. But they threw so much money at me, I just couldn't. It was funny because everybody in the corner was mad. Everybody was mad, mad, mad. They're like, we're going to write this. And so I went up and talked to them. I went up with my Michael Braverman, my agent at the time, great guy, great grad. And so you know, they paid me off with, like, you know, they pay cash there. And it's like a stupid amount of cash. So I took all the money. It's all in, you know, bundles of $100 bills, right? And I spread it out all over my bed. And I lay on top of my bed with my arms crossed behind my head and relaxing. And then I get the phone call. I tell everybody, I say, all right, you gotta come to my room. I'm going to tell you what the game plan is. So everyone runs to my room. What are we going to do? And they all land on this stack. I go, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm buying drinks tonight, guys.
That's
we can't do anything about it anyways, right? You know, it was what it was. You know, I mean, Japan just, you know, you know going in there that you might not get a fair shake, and you know, and so you know that going in. It's not like
the Olympics or something where everything is like supposed to be. I mean, it's a pro organization, so there's a lot of business stuff that happens in there.
Well, there's no regulation. There's no boxing commission. There's no independent regulation of it. So, you know, they can do what they want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's interesting. And then all that Yakuza stuff that comes out with Pride. I mean, you know, I don't think a lot. Yeah. I mean, people in the United States are kind of desensitized to the idea of mafia involved with, you know, pro boxing and things that, so they don't necessarily think of it in Japan, but it's kind of a similar thing with the pro fight game out there.
A lot of the entertainments are run by Yakuza owned businesses. So Yakuza owned businesses. Yeah,
that's gnarly.
That's what I mean, you know, like I said, I that's what I've been told, you know. So, but you know, it was just kind of one of those crazy things, you know. It's like I knew, you know. Yeah, Sakuraba, you know, he don't hit hard, so I knew I wouldn't have to worry about getting hit. I said that really what I had to worry about was his ability to submit me. And but I was, you know, like one of the skill sets I had good, which is always showing me, is I was always good at taking, stopping the takedown, and then if I get taken down, was always escaping. So, you know, and we worked on that. We just worked on my ability to stop his takedown and try to knuckle him up. you know? And, you know, to be honest, I was like, yeah, I was getting, you know, because of my illness and because of stuff, I wasn't, you know, I couldn't have pressed. I had a tough time really pressing the fight when I had him. I had him hurt once, and it was just like, I figured I'd won the fight. You know what I mean? I'd done enough to win the fight, you know? And I was like, you know, what I didn't want to do is get tired in the last 3 minutes and him getting me, you know what I mean?
Right.
And, cause he was a master at that. I mean, he's, you know, love him or hate him. Most people love that guy. Cause he's such a clown, and he's in a good way clown. You know, but you know, you cannot discount really how good a submission guy he was.
Yeah. Don't sleep on him.
Yeah. Especially that, wow. Double wrist lock Kimura, you know?
Yeah. So how did after the fight and everything, I mean, how did that play out with your kidney and stuff? I mean, surgery or something? Or?
Well, I've always had, since the kidney condition, I had a tougher time, you know, getting in, like, you know, the amazing shape I used to be in. I was always in good shape, but never like I was before the kidney issue. And so, you know, but, you know, I haven't had too many issues from it since, you know. And, you know, as I get older, I have to be concerned about it, but it's kind of one of the reasons I got into the medical field and became a doctor. So treat myself, if physician, heal thyself, as they say.
So tell me about that journey. I mean, when do you start that? Cause that seems like a whole, it's like, that's insane. I mean, that just seems like a whole other journey. Like most people can't do both lives. You know what I mean? They,
but
like,
you know what? That's only because people believe in limitation. You should know more than anybody, you know, than that is that we buy into other people's interpretations of us.
Yes.
And I was bad about it. Like, you know, I was the fighter. I was this, you know, and so I bought into that, you know, not being the bright. I didn't have an education. I didn't finish college. That's what people don't realize. They thought I did because of my wrestle in college. Right. But I didn't finish college.
Right.
So, you know, and you know, and I bought into the same story people were telling me, oh, you know, what you do. And you know, be honest, man, I got to thank Mark Cuban, man. Mark Cuban. If you're familiar, he's the owner of the Mavericks. He's a billionaire, right?
Yeah, yeah.
A really big visionary guy.
And he's there in Texas too, right?
Yeah, he lives here in Texas. And so he bought my consulting business and made me the president of the new division in the combat sport division was HGNet. It's Axis TV now, but it was HGNet at the time.
Right.
And, you know, and basically, you know, he listened to this proposal I had and literally he goes, we're going to have a meeting. He literally calls me up and he goes, hey guy, this is Mark. I'm thinking, Mark who, right? You know, he's talking like we're long lost brothers or something, you know? And so I'm like, yeah, like this. And I go, hey, I said, man, I couldn't tell who the number is, which Mark is. He goes, this is Mark Cuban. I'm like, I'm looking around because my stat, we play practical jokes on each other at pretty intricate ones at the gym. So I'm looking around to see who's, you know, messing with me, right? And I'm like, yeah, whatever, you know? And he goes, no, seriously, it is. And I go, okay. And then he goes, yeah, hey, can you fly out to Vegas for a meeting tomorrow? And I was like, all right. You know, we'll just meet for an hour and you can fly back. I said, okay. So we ended up going there and I ended up, you know, just having this talk. And then I said, Mark, this is the future. This is the future sport. There's no other sport that is going to take off like this. I go, boxing didn't take off like this because they didn't have television. They didn't have the internet. They said, I go, your ability to get this out. I said, it's going to be huge, blah, blah, blah. And he bought it and he bought into it. Right? Literally, it went from a 1 hour meeting to a 5 hour meeting. Then he said, hey, man, you got to spend the night. We're going to go out. I said, okay. By the way, going out as a billionaire in Vegas is a lot more fun than the normal one.
Oh, man, I can't even imagine, dude. Holy shit.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So I highly recommend it every once in a while. Yeah.
Go find yourself a billionaire.
Yeah, yeah. Go be a billionaire for the day. And but anyway, so, you know, and then so we came the one programming on that station. And you know, Mark was, you know, I'd sit down and Mark would thing, and he goes, you're good at this, but I can tell it's not your passion. And I go, well, I said, to be honest, I really enjoy making things. I enjoy the idea that we took this from ground up, made it the number one programming on deal. But I go, a television's not my dream. You know what I mean? It's not, you know, yeah. He goes, well, what is? I go, I'll be honest. I go, if I wasn't a poor kid, you know, who had to struggle through stuff. I said, I'd have been a doctor. He goes, why don't you be a doctor now? And I was like, because I'm married, I got children, I got all this other stuff going on. He goes, you can live in limitation or you can live your dream. And I love that saying.
Yeah.
I don't know if he read that somewhere or what, but, and so I started investigating going back to school, and I did, but you know, I ended up not doing the DO program or MD program, but the PhD program, just because the reality was that I was still a president of a television company. I still had to, you know, I had family, you know, and stuff. And
I have college roommates that, you know, actually he went all the way and he's like a neurosurgeon at Madison, University of Wisconsin-Madison. And dude, I mean, it's just, I mean, a PhD is like crazy in itself. I have a master's degree, but PhD is like a whole other level. An MD, dude, but doing all those like the rounds and all that kind of stuff, that I don't think that's realistic when you have a family and you're running a company and everything else.
Yeah, well, it was impossible. But, you know, I was a holistic health practitioner. So I work with, you know, I work in a clinical, I mostly do research, right? You know, and we can do a whole podcast on some of the amazing opportunities that I've had to work with some of the cutting edge stuff. I have been involved in new plasma and laser, you know, the new, you know, therapeutic lasers. I mean, I've had the opportunity, you know, just dumb luck falling into some of this shit, and especially the new plasma is amazing. The new peptide stuff out there. I mean, this is a whole different podcast because I can geek out on this for hours, and it's some interesting stuff. But you know, I've had this thing, and so I do clinical work because you know I work under the auspices of a medical director, so who oversees anything I do. I'm a naturopathic oriented, but we, you know, we do allopathic medicine too in our practice, you know, and
sure.
And yeah, like I said, I'm overseen by a medical director and physician. So, but you know, I enjoy it. I like the idea that I'm helping people and not punching them in the face anymore. I think that, I think that, yeah, it's like, you know, when I tell people I'm a doctor, I do, and when I'm doing that, they look at me and they're like, you can tell them like they're trying to figure out, am I joking
or bullshitting or what?
Yeah. How did this guy who goes, who obviously enjoyed punching people in the face, to a guy who is like enjoying, like, you know, helping people, you know, with their diabetes and their, you know, and stroke victims and things, you know? And so, you know, so, but I, you know, like I said, I believe that you know, there's an old Hebrew saying that a man without change grows stale. And I fought professionally for 17 years. Well, people don't realize I had two careers. I had a boxing, kickboxing career, and then an MMA career. Because I was trying to end my career as a fighter when MMA took off, and I started making – and I made more money than I ever seen before, and I was like, wow, you know. And to be honest, I made a really great living overseas in Japan. And I enjoyed it. But it came to an end. And I lost to the all undefeated champion of the fight business, Father Time. He ain't lost one yet.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he took me out and it was just like, you know, I tell my children that they can be what they want to be, that they do. And you know, and I'm sitting there, you know, I'm sitting there telling that and I'm afraid to go back to school. I'm afraid to take these chances. I was like, you know, and I was, I'm not kidding. You know, I mean, you know, I wasn't the best student or anything. I didn't know if I could finish. I didn't know if I could do it. You know, and it was important, you know, I mean, it was an important thing. And it's given me, like I said, it's allowed me to have a perspective in which I can teach children better, that I can relate to people on all sorts of different levels. You know, when I talk, especially when I do some of more inspirational stuff, you know, I'd like, there's very few people that's had the different occupations and lives that I have. I think about it, I wouldn't probably trade it for anything. I enjoyed almost all my experiences, and what I was doing. You know, I enjoyed the fight business. I enjoyed the contracting business. I enjoyed the science business, you know, being a scientist. I enjoy being a clinician. And, and I just think people live in too many limitations, you know, and they allow other people to dictate, you know, their happiness. And
well, it's interesting you say that because when you were talking about that, about, you know, not living a life of limitation and not living what other people's expectations are too, you know, it's something that I call, I got the concept from a author named Harry Brown, He wrote a book called How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. This was like in the 70s when it came out. But he had this cool concept that really stuck with me at a young age. And really, I totally get what you're saying. It's like he called it an identity trap. And yeah. I think a lot of people get stuck in these like identity traps, like, oh, you're a fighter. And so that means you only get to look at this part of the menu, the fighter menu, and you can't go look at the intellectual stuff or, you know, and that's all such bullshit. Like, you're totally right. You got to just do what you fucking want to do. You know what I mean?
Plus, to be honest, the two aren't exclusive. The greatest warriors are also our greatest intellectual guys.
Agreed.
You know what I mean? And stuff. And it'll be honest, my wife is probably my greatest inspiration, which sounds funny, right? You know, but she is, because, you know.
Dude, you post on Facebook all the time, and you guys seem to have such an amazing marriage and relationship.
I like to think so. I mean, I hope she feels the same way about me. But she, you know, here's a woman who, you know, who really was, you know, in a, you know, she didn't come from, you know, she came from a, you know, middle class, you know, probably slightly lower part of that spectrum. You know, a good hardworking family. She, you know, she's the prom queen. She's the model. She's Miss Teen Georgia. You know what I mean? She's this, and then she gets pregnant and has a baby at 18. You know, and so, you know, she's this story. Didn't go to college, didn't do this stuff. You know, she's what, you know, a bad 70s made for TV movies, you know, subject matter, right?
She was still a kid when she had a kid.
Yeah. And instead, you know, my wife should literally write a book, because it's not where, you know, it's not how much money you have or anything. It's where you start and where you end up. What's the distance between that, right? Yep. And you know, she started, you know, she didn't start at zero. She started at -5. You know?
Right.
And she's a freaking rock star in her business, in her stuff. She has transformed herself from this. And I've seen it even since we married, but I wouldn't say was mousy, but not assertive, not confident, not this. You know, when I first met her, I was thinking, man, she's so beautiful, so smart. And she was dating this idiot. And I said, obviously she's dating this idiot because she doesn't think well of herself. Right.
Yeah.
And I seen this transformation in her, and she's like, she is a rock star in her business. She is an absolute rock star. And the support of our family, she's this amazing mom. And people think I'm an amazing dad. I'm really not. What I am is I have an amazing wife. And so in all honesty, when I introduce her and people go, you know, you always hear people go, here's my better half. When I introduce her, I go, here's my better three-fourths, because she is,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And she's my inspiration. I look, you know, I'm not here to impress my father no more. I'm not here to impress anybody. Who I'm here to impress is my freaking wife. You know, I want her to know, you know what? She didn't marry some schmuck. So, you know, because she deserves to have a great man. And I will never be a great man, but I it won't keep me from trying.
And, yeah. You know, dude, that's the thing, is it's like, it's such an interesting time. And you know, I feel like, you know, it's okay to maybe shift gears a little bit here, because you are such a multidimensional guy. You know, it's an interesting time, especially to be a man or a young man. Because, you know, and I hate to use the word role model or whatever, but, you know, there aren't a lot of places for young men and young women to see positive, successful, strong marriages, you know, anymore. And I am not a conservative guy. I'm not even a religious guy, but I do think it's important, because I'm in the same boat. Like, you know, I'm married, been with my wife like 14 years now. And, you know, I'm really consider myself a family man first and foremost. And I, you know, I really kind of, connect with a lot of the things that you're saying at that level. It's just interesting. This is maybe my awkward, but I don't know, it doesn't seem awkward to me, transitioned into like a topic that's totally off base, and all the MMA people are probably going to be like tuning out like droves, but I think it's fascinating. And that's the great thing about having your own podcast. You can talk about whatever the fuck you want to talk about. And, yeah. And one of the things that you and I have in common is that we're both Freemasons.
Yeah.
And I think that in this day and age, it's a really important group, and it's sad because I know the membership rolls are down like crazy, drastic.
Crazy. Yeah.
But, you know, in this age of all this crazy, you know, everything
you
online,
know what the problem
and all
is?
This stuff, there's not a place for men to learn to be better with other men, you know?
Yes. The problem is, the absolute problem is, you're exactly right. Here's the issue. we do not have, you know, our parents, God love them, you know, did their very best, but they were part of the drones. They were part of that other stuff. Most of them, not all of them, but you know, majority of them. So, you know, you were taught to go to school, don't cause trouble. You know, get your education, go to college, get a job. You know, in the 70s, it was like you get a job or you get go, or join the union. Right. And, and work, you know, work your 30 years, get your pension and go off. Right. You know what I mean? And so what there was this disconnect between, especially with boys, you know, I mean, I can only speak from the male perspective, you know, but I see it in the female perspective is like where people teaching our children are not us. You know,
no, it's Kim Kardashian.
It's the television. It's these other things because we're so busy, you know, making a living that it's hard for us to do this all the time. And so there is, you know, the fact that we're screwed up as men is not necessarily our fault. We have had, you know, we've had this conditioning put on us by well-meaning people called our parents who or society who meant well. That wasn't an insidious mean thing. It was just like, you know, this is what they believe was the best thing. And what is stifled is, there is no reason why you cannot be, you know, and there's a famous Greek general who said, you know, I'm paraphrasing this, who basically said, you know, a country that, you know, that has warriors who don't, you know, who aren't thinkers, you know, basically have, you know, idiot, violent idiots, you know.
Yeah.
Who thinkers who aren't warriors have people too weak to lead.
Right.
And so, you know, what we've had is, you know, we have this acceptance of, you know, of mediocrity. We have this acceptance of, you know, it is not a, you know, I'm not a fan of the of everybody getting a trophy thing. Right. And everyone talks about that. But it's like, I think you should be acknowledged for going out and fighting or get acknowledged for playing the soccer game as hard as you can. But just because you show up doesn't mean you should be acknowledged because let's say you're not the best soccer player, but you bust your ass. And let's say you don't win. You should be acknowledged for busting your ass. You don't get acknowledged for showing up. You get acknowledged for busting your ass, whether you're good or not. You know, when you step in the ring, you know, you should be acknowledged for having courage to do that.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And stuff like that. But you don't get the trophy. You don't get to hold your hand up over your head and brag that you won, okay, unless you win, right?
Right.
But we've taken that away. And we have emasculated this thing. So we the ridiculous of it is that we set people like me at certain points and our famous basketball players and football players, we put them on this pedestal as if they're so like this. When the reality is it really should be every single one of us stepping up on that pedestal because we're busting our asses. Now there's going to be the ones that are better than us at certain things, whether it's sports or whatever. But you know what? I don't have any more admiration for the guy who wins the Heisman Trophy than I have for a guy who's just an amazing dad.
You know? Right.
And so you know, the thing is that we mess up like that, and this is a mistake. And here's a mistake we make with young fighters. And hopefully that we didn't lose all the MMA guys because here you go, guys. Here's what it is. You being a fighter don't make you a man. All right. That doesn't make you a man. You know what? It's in nature. For me to fight, you know, because the way I grew up, that's like rewarding a dog for barking. It's in his nature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It is in my nature. What is not in my nature is being rational, set back. Don't let my emotions control me. That's what people give me that a boy for.
Yeah, because you know it's like you watch the UFC now and all the pre-fight hype, and it just is like a bad gangster rap video now. It's so cheesy. Yeah. And like, you're totally right. It's people aren't learning how to circumscribe their passions.
Yes. And so the thing is that these guys, you know, these guys, if you're a young athlete, you're listening to this thing, finish your college education. If your career outside of the fight business is going to, like me, the only reason I went back to school was my career choice required me to have initials after my name. You know what I mean?
Right.
But to be honest, I read so much information and stuff way before I went in there that I opted out of over 2 years of schooling because of taking the life experience test, you know, and because of everything I read, right? And so the thing is that, you know, when you fight, it's a business. It's not just about fighting. You want to be successful, you got to figure out how you're going to make the money. you know, and Conor McGregor, yeah, I mean, it's a clown fest and everything, but he is a millionaire now, right?
Because he's worth the business. What I don't like is the constant libel and the just it looks unseemly, you know?
The problem is there's less intelligent men than Conor McGregor going at it.
True.
And so, you know, they look like pale shadows to these guys, you know, and to someone like him who, you know, is a master manipulator and stuff like that.
Very smart.
You know, I tell people all the time, man, the fighting is only part of your business. It's a small part of your business. The rest of it is managing how you're going to do with your, you know, with this. How do you position yourself so you can make the most amount of money? What are you going to do outside? How are you going to make money outside of the ring because you were in the ring? You know,
right.
How do you do things? So, you better wake up, because what's going to happen is you're going to wake up one day, you're going to be in the span of these athletes are much shorter than my day. Right. Now, I had a 17-year-long career. 10 of it was MMA.
That's, you know,
not many guys have 10-year careers anymore, right?
That's
let
amazing.
Alone 17 years, right? And so, you know, so take a lesson from a guy who never thought it was going to end, you know, in the fact that, you know, this is that you got to prepare for it. And you know what? Not only will you succeed after your career as an athlete, you'll enjoy your career as an athlete better, because there will not be a sense of desperation. There won't be a sense of other stuff. You know, you will expand who you are as a person. You know, you know, the guys who wholly identify themselves as fighters are guys who rarely will be successful. One, two, they're going to be in a huge amount of disappointment when their success either doesn't come or is cut real short. Right. I tell people all the time, you want to fight, you better like the training. You better love the experience of doing the martial arts, of doing the practice, because you may never make it. And if you do, great. If you don't, great. Because the experience was you would do it anyways. And I'll tell you truthfully, I'd have fought for free anyways, because I loved it. I loved the competition. I loved what was going on with it. I had a passion for it. I had a skill for it, you know.
But there's nothing wrong with you making money with it either.
No, there isn't. No. But what I'm saying is that if you have passion for something, money comes. And even if it doesn't come, it's still a rewarding experience. And life should be about that. Life shouldn't be about serious disappointments. I mean, life should be about how do we make every situation as win-win as we can, you know? And not all of them will be, obviously. But the fact is, these kids come in so blind and stuff. I get it all the time. I want to do this. I want to do that. I go, what's your backup? What do you mean? I said, what if you break your leg training? Well, that won't happen. I go, no, it happens all the time to athletes, all the time. I said, I have a consulting business that trains professional football players. And why they come to me specifically is that I'm really good at making them bulletproof. None of my guys really get hurt because of the way I train them, right? I train them specifically to reinforce, you know, the tendons and joints and their hips, their back and their knees and ankles, right? And so, you know, we work on that. But there's so many guys that, you know, great. I mean, look at Bo Jackson, one of the best athletes in the entire world, had a hip injury, never could do it again.
Yeah.
So we look at that, like, you know, I mean, you got to be prepared. And that's what, again, like I said, if you enjoy the experience, then it's never a bad experience, whether it gets cut short or not. You know what I mean?
Well, the thing that I like in particular about the fight game is that, you know, anybody can kind of enter. I mean, not anybody, but what I mean is that it's not like you need a master's degree or even a bachelor's degree to go fight. Anybody from any socioeconomic level can go and try to make it in this sport and then try to learn the business and have a transition once you're done fighting into maybe doing something to make some money. But it is a mindset. And I think a lot of these guys, you know, they have maybe they're wrong, these young guys, they have the wrong idea or the wrong motivation for getting involved in the sport, you know? And I think that part of it is that, you know, and forgive me for bringing it all the way back to Freemasonry, but I know that you wanted to tell your story, how you came in to becoming a Mason.
Yeah. This actually kind of ties into what we're talking about here. You know, I realized, you know, later in life, after being a complete jackass for most of it, that the reason I was successful was because of other people's sacrifices for me.
Yes.
Like, you know, I remember being upset with my mom because we were poor. And we lived in an area in Plano, Texas, which is anything but poor. And my mom busted her ass to get us into a home that we couldn't afford, into a school district that we couldn't afford. And she busted her ass. She raised four kids, four boys, all in a row. And I'm such a grateful shithead that I'm sitting there mad at her because, you know, I don't have a car when all my other friends have cars. That all my friends, you know, they got to go to any college they wanted to go to. I had to go to the one, not that I didn't want to go, but you know, the one where it offered me the scholarship, right? You know, it was this thing where it's like, and I didn't even, I had coaches that helped. I had a coach who taught me how to read, you know what I mean?
Wow.
You know, I have dyslexia, right? And he sat down and got my passion for reading, which has changed my life, right? And I wasn't appreciative of that. I wasn't even that appreciative until it was pointed out to me about my training partners who busted their ass, never missed training with me, even when it was like we were getting hurt and all this other stuff. And some of them didn't have the same careers that I did. And so they're there busting their ass. And I wouldn't be where I am if it wasn't because of other people, you know, with very little gratitude out of me. And so I, in my feeling guilty and feeling like I do, I'm huge about paying forward. And of course I believe in doing everything as big as you can. And masonry, these guys work on being better men. I want to be a better man. I want this. And on top of it, the amount of charity work they do is staggering. People have no idea. The top pediatric orthopedic hospital in the United States, fourth in the world, is here in Dallas, Texas. It's a Mason hospital, you know.
Yeah, and the Shriners,
Scottish Rites Hospital,
and the Shriners too. I mean, there's a ton of, yes. And people just have no idea that this organization is there. They're just, they see stupid conspiracy videos on YouTube and have no idea really what.
Oh, dude, I love it because you know what? What I have found is that I used to be kind of libertarian by nature, but I changed that because people are too stupid for their own good these days. And so I'm looking forward to the whole Illuminati thing where it's all the mind control and everything, because I don't know much of it, and they've yet to talk about it to me, but I'm waiting for it because I'm ready for that. I'm ready for that conspiracy to go, because I'm a little disappointed with my fellow human being lately. And so it's like I'm waiting for that. So it's complete, you know. Here's the thing is that, you know, they get an idea. Like when I first was raised, and I was my place was in New York. I spent a lot of time in New York and Dallas. So I ended up, joining the Mason, because masonry in New York is bigger than it is in Texas right now. Texas used to be huge, but it's not. So I joined a lodge up there. And when I was raised, they were asking me if there was something I want to do. And I was like, yeah, you know, it was a bad winter. And so I said, you know, all these homeless people, you know, they're going to freeze, man. You know, and I feel bad for homeless people. I got to know a bunch of homeless people. We do a lot of homeless charities for homeless shelters here in Texas with my gym, and particularly the ones that deal with families and children. But I'm sitting there, they're going to freeze. And so they said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, let's start like a coat drive. So literally on my suggestion, and I went and talked to some of the other lodges, we literally got the lodges to start collecting jackets and stuff like that. And in 2 weeks, we got over 30,000 jackets in the Long Island and upper West Side masonry lodges, and handed them out to people. Over 30,000. Can you, in 2 weeks?
That's unbelievable.
That's how powerful they are. That is motivated Ben. That's motivated men who want to make a difference in people's lives, right? There are 30,000 people that probably made it through the winter, or at least a lot warmer, because of a suggestion that I made. Do I feel like I could never have done that by myself? I could never have done that by myself. You know, I might have raised a couple of hundred, maybe, you know, because of my influence in Dallas, but because of my influence as a Mason, you know, in their expanded it past, way past what I could do, because we had other brothers that thought the way that this is a good idea. You know what I mean? And let's do it. Right. And so these are the kind of things that masonry can do. You know what I mean? And on top of it, they challenge you to be a better man. They challenge you to be a better man, an intellectual, you know, a man, you know what I mean? They, you know, you think about the great, our greatest presidents, you know, Like George Washington, he wasn't the greatest president, but he was our most honest president. He was our most fun. I mean, people don't realize, man, they thought when he, at the end of the war, they thought, man, he's going to make himself king. He's got the army behind him. He's got all this stuff like this. He walked into the Continental Congress, took his sword off and said, I'm going home. I'm done.
Yeah. It's amazing.
He was an honest man.
Like that anymore. That would just eschew the power.
Yes. And Teddy Roosevelt, my personal hero, you know, and by the way, the very first mixed martial art president ever. He was
actually pivotal in catch wrestling too, because Roosevelt, being the martial artist that you mentioned, Tom Jenkins, who was a major champion, he ended up giving him a job because Tom Jenkins couldn't read. And after being a champion, he was broke because he got taken advantage of. Teddy Roosevelt gave him a job as the head martial arts instructor or self-defense instructor at West Point Military Academy. Teddy Roosevelt was a
Teddy used to have matches. He would put wrestlers against judo players. And if people realize, he lost most of his eyesight from a sparring match. He got thumbed in the eye.
Oh.
You know, as president, right? You know? And I'm a huge Teddy Roosevelt fan. I know all sorts of crazy stuff about him. And in fact, I was on my lodge is on Long Island, of course. You know, Teddy's a Long Island guy. He's an Oyster Bay guy. And I went up to his original home up there, which was really the white, where he spent most of his time. He didn't really spend a huge amount of time in the White House, but he spent on this thing on Long Island. And, and they had this whole history out there, and it was just amazing. Got all these crazy, great facts about him. But here's a man who was born in wealth, and his father must've been an amazing man, because his father taught him a lot about, like, yeah, you were born with these privileges, but it's your responsibility to look out for the guys who weren't. And, and he took that to word, obviously, man. Here's a man with, very wealthy, that looked out for the little guy. And that's the cool thing about masonry. It doesn't matter where you are. If you could be the butler, but if you're the worshipful master of the lodge,
yeah,
I would have to take his instruction.
Yeah.
And so it was an opportunity to make all men equal.
Yep.
In the lodge. You know, and there's not color in the lodge. There's not race in the lodge. There's not economics in the lodge. And there's not politics in the lodge.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's interesting you said that, you had libertarian leanings, but your faith in the general population has led you to question that. And that's interesting, too, because, I'm often conflicted that with my, by myself, which is, I think, the issues that the founders, who were, many of them were Masons, when they were developing the system of government, they were like, we want to give people freedom, but then you realize that you give people so much freedom that maybe, if they're not invested in being their best selves, that freedom can be pretty toxic sometimes to some of these people, and they might need help. And what's interesting is before, Social Security and before welfare and all that kind of stuff, those kind of social safety nets weren't provided by the government. They were actually provided by the fraternal organizations. And in fact, that was, many people go into into masonry or what, any other kind of fraternal order, but they go in because there's a million reasons. For myself, I was interested in kind of the esoteric information, the philosophy, the hermeticism, but a lot of people are there because it is like a fraternity. It's a big social network and whatnot. But back then, your dues went into a giant pot. And if somebody fell ill, it was basically how insurance started, like health insurance and life insurance. If you fell ill, your brothers took care of you and your family.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think a lot, like I said, if you look at almost all of the, all those fraternities, especially turn of the century, they're all basically were on that. They were basically, insurance, for their members to make sure that they were, taken care of in case there was, an issue.
I think that might be part of the reason why the introduction of a state-funded welfare system is a big reason why the roles
have continued to drop is that, you know, and why masonry has gone from that kind of function into more just charitable in general functions, even though you'll still take care of your brothers and all that kind of stuff. But there, it's like the state is taking it out of people's paycheck involuntarily versus something like a fraternal order where you join and, you know, it's not forcefully taken out of your check through withholding, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, listen, I understand, you know, I mean, there's the, again, the that's the libertarian side of you coming out and
yeah.
And it's fine. You know, I mean, but it's also that the problem is that we have those that will, you know, take advantage of these situations. And, you know, but listen, I'm not a fan of taxation, but I understand why we have to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, the thing about it is just that it's not, for me, it bothers me is the taxation program is not, it's not an equitable one. It doesn't reflect, you know, it does not reflect, you know, an equitable exchange of, you know, services and advantages and everything.
I think all that could be very easily solved. I don't know who in the hell would actually advocate for this because, you know, nobody's going to like restrict the money coming into their own pockets. But, you know, something like where at least I could choose where my taxes go.
Yeah.
Because I would rather, look, if it's going to be taken out of my check, I would rather as you, because like for me, like homeless and pet rescue, and I have my own causes and I'd love the money to go there instead of bombing people with billion-dollar bombs that I never met before, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's, you're preaching to the choir on that, but, you know, but the problem is too, is that, you know, man, we spend a huge amount of time on this one, man. It's another whole podcast. Yeah,
that's true.
Because you're looking at, you know.
I hate to interrupt, but for brevity's sake, then, so what was it? Like, how did you actually get involved in masonry? Was there a brother, or did you stumble on it and have to go find one? Or?
No, actually, my what it was I, you know, like you, I love the esoteric part about it and stuff. And I've read a lot of, you know, I'm a big fan of reading spiritual texts, all kinds of them. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, I'm obviously, you know, you follow my thing. I'm more of a Christian tenet, but I'm also a spiritualist who believes in that we don't understand everything, and that I'm open to, you know, to, I'm open to listening to people talk about their thing, you know, about their beliefs. I'm okay with that. You know,
I think all the religions have at least something to offer. You may not agree with everything, but there's wisdom in most of the spiritual traditions.
Yeah. So what I look at is the fact that, you know, I love that aspect of it. I love the mystery behind it. The whole part of it that there, I love the idea of the brotherhood. And a friend of mine named Derek Panza, you might know him. He was a world kickboxing champion, a training partner of mine, and just one of the best human beings I know. I met him in Long Island when I was dating a girl there. We became really good friends. He's like a brother. And, you know, and he was the same way. He, you know, he started his masonry practice, and I was like talking to him, and he's like, yeah, I went and did this, you know, and because I used to give him books about it. I go this, and so he got interested from me, and so I ended up joining the lodge with him. He actually was. He was raised before me. I mean, he was there before me, but you know, he's the one who introduced me to the lodge, and I joined.
That's great. So how long have you been, when were you raised?
I was raised in 2004.
Oh, wow. So you've been a brother for a while then.
Yeah.
It's funny. I just want to tell you this story, because I think you might get a kick of it. I was actually, when I first learned really about it, you know, I'd heard about it and I had some relatives that were involved, but I never really cared. But I was actually going to Frank Shamrock's school in San Jose for some training thing. And one of the guys there with me, this brother who I still, you know, obviously keep in touch with today, Trey Vaden, he was going through the process and kind of enlightened me about what it was actually all about. It took me about 10 years, but I eventually did it. But it was actually, I wouldn't have, I don't think
Hello?
If I hadn't been at Frank Shamrock's, I wouldn't
have been. Are you there, man?
Can you hear me? Hello?
Hello?
Can you hear me?
There you go. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I was just telling the story that I went to to work out at Frank Shamrock's gym in San Jose. This had to be 2007, and that was where I first got involved because one of the guys there was going through the process and explained to me what it actually was all about. So it's kind of a small world that I'm sitting here talking to you about it. That's a little weird, but yeah, that's great, man. I was really excited to see that you were involved.
I would like to see more people get involved. I think it would help out a lot of things. I think the world is confusing about what it is to be a man today. I think they do a pretty good job. You know what I mean? And it's not like the macho bullshit either. Part of being a man, but the fact of the matter is, it's also about a man understanding responsibility, especially to his fellow man.
Yes, sir. And
I think that's missing. Hey, Jake, man, listen, I got another meeting.
I know we could talk for hours. Maybe I'll get you on again in the future. I really appreciate you.
Hey, listen, I'd love to talk about some more. I'd love to get into, like, you know, a lot of things that, we're doing and you know, and I'll tell you, instead of jumping around a lot, I would love to sit down with you and just go over what I, you know, with the catch wrestling. So I have some ideas for catch wrestling that needs to be, I think they should do, just because I've seen the success of other sports and the growth of other sports. And
yes, sir.
No, and catch wrestling needs to, you know, kind of follow the same deal if they're going to want to be successful. So,
well, I definitely want to talk to you, and we'll, maybe we'll save that. We'll tease that for the next time. In the meantime, people want to contact you, obviously Facebook, but, you know, they maybe want to work out or some for any other reason. What's the best way for people to contact you?
Okay, well, if you want to contact me about gym stuff, it's, you know, the gym is, you know, guymesger.com is the website. Come that, you know, come there, join me. You can email me from there. If you're interested in the health aspect of what I do, the company is Optimal Health Specialist, and you would reach me, my email, which would be, you know, info@ohsmedical.com, and then get hold of
ohsmedical.com.
Yeah. And, you know, we do a lot. So I know a lot of, you know, I have good contacts with people all over the United States that have the same proactive health philosophy that I do and can help people out.
Guy, I really appreciate you being so generous with your time, my friend.
Oh, my pleasure, man. I had a good time. Okay. I look forward to doing it again with you, okay?
Okay, likewise. Take care. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.